Welcome to the Reimagining Podcast with Theodore Richards. The Reimagining Podcast is a production of Wisdom Projects Incorporated, a 501c3 nonprofit organization which includes the Baltimore Wisdom Project and the Chicago Wisdom Project. Our shared mission is to reimagine education and reimagine the world by enhancing the lives of youth and adults with holistic education, intercultural understanding, and anti-oppressive, liberationist thought leadership.
School is often conceived of as the realm of the intellect or mind. In school, there's no time for the emotional, no time to ask big questions about our place in the world, no time for community, because it is only about individual success. Perhaps what is required is to knock down all the schools and churches, get rid of them altogether, find learning and community elsewhere. And perhaps we ought not to build anything in their place. Sit outside in circles, walk through forests, tell stories and sing songs, learn about the traditions of our ancestors and how they answered the big questions so that we might find answers of our own. Care for each other. Love each other. This is church. This is school. The ultimate goal, of course, is not to make a better school or a better church. It is to make more compassionate, just, and sustainable communities. This requires an educational process that allows for a reimagining of the self, recognizing ourselves as mandalas, a unique expression of a web of relationships that includes the whole planet, the whole cosmos. We cannot rediscover this without an educational process that facilitates a thorough transformation of human culture. Where, at this apocalyptic moment, might we discover and rediscover this new human? I would suggest that just as we are at the edge of our world right now as a species, there are plenty of places we can look to find people for whom living at the edge is nothing new. We often refer to these people as marginalized, and there is a particular wisdom at the margins. For those who reside there have not benefited from the current systems. They see the brokenness of our world, but they also can see the possibilities. If we can create an educational process that allows for them to reimagine the deficit narratives, the new story, in other words, won't come from the old centers of power, nor will it emerge if we educate from there. Miss Tree Turtle, MFA, MA, LPN, CTC, CCR, also known as Kleissa Bani, is the co-director and lead teaching artist with Gabriel Pickus of the Baltimore Wisdom Project and the co-director with Dr. Theodore Richards and Mr. Gabriel Pickus of Wisdom Projects, Inc. Since 1986, for over 34 years, she has worked as a healer, teacher, multi-genre artist, nonprofit manager, restorative practitioner, mindfulness educator, herbalist, and advocate for justice for underserved children and adults. She's a former nurse who holds multiple certifications in trauma-informed care, community counseling, conflict transformation, and several kinds of holistic healing practices. She possesses a lifelong commitment to whole person, evidence-based behavioral and public health practice. She was a certified public school teacher for multiple grades and subjects, including language arts, social studies, PE, and life sciences in Baltimore, Maryland, and Columbus, Ohio. She has taught and designed curricula extensively for public schools, private schools, community centers, jails, prisons, juvenile justice facilities, and 10 colleges and universities. As a nonprofit leader, she has helped 11 different 501c3 organizations uplift their operations, communications, and fundraising. For over 30 years, she has been a Theravadan Buddhist Pasika, originally ordained in Thailand by Mechi Chandra Konokyun. She's a peace advocate, activist, metaphysical naturalist, environmentalist, animal protector, child protector, water protector, air protector, and anti-abuse advocate. For all her professional life, she's been committed to radically nurturing, community elevating, restorative, and transformative justice and practice. She's also a longtime editor and writer who has published journalism, essay, poems, and fiction in over 30 journals and magazines since 1988. For further information, visit www.treeturtle.com and www.baltimorewisdomproject.org. So it is my great joy to introduce to everyone Miss Tree Turtle, our guest today on Reimagining, where we'll be reimagining healing, which is a particular passion of Miss Tree. Welcome.
Thank you. I am gratified enormously to be with you and to share in this podcast with the public.
It's a particular gift to have you here, Miss Tree, because you are, in addition to being a guest, you're also co-director at Wisdom Projects, Inc., which is the organization that creates this podcast, and a dear friend and colleague. So I'm really happy to have you here. So we're talking today about healing, and I think I want to dive right in by getting your perspective on a few terms that I know you like to use when you think about healing. So something you talk about a lot is trauma-informed practice. Can you talk a little bit about what that means to you and how you put that into practice?
Yes, I would love to talk about trauma-informed care, but it might first be important to go back deep within ourselves and to try to perform this blessed exercise whenever we're asked to define the hurt and suffering that is so present within the world, and to imagine within our remembering of the yolk that is within the egg that birthed us. And within that yolk and within that womb, we will see that there is always present a need. Every one of us needs. And that need can be as fundamental as nourishment, or it can be as sophisticated as tenderness. Restorative practice and restorative justice and healing and even trauma-informed care is the work of responding to that need to be whole and to maintain the wholeness that is predicated within our existence. We would like to think that we are exceptional first and foremost, but there is always that need yoked within us, hollering to be restored, begging to be healed, even just whispering indirectly. Sometimes that need is so metastasized, so attacked within one or more events by people or forces, that it produces a disruption greater than anything that might come within our bodies and minds. And that attack, that pronounced suffering, is trauma. Trauma is not only an external experience of this terrible disruption in the blessings of our needs, it's also an internal manifestation that puts different concepts of what it means to be alive within our brains and rewires the way we breathe, the way fluid circulates through our body, the way we digest, all of the fundamental ways in which we try to be whole as human beings. When we are aware deeply of all the vicissitudes of that trauma, and we have greatly studied ways to execute high levels of restorative care, then we are trauma-informed, informed by the fact of that trauma that we often give short shrift to. And that is why it's called trauma-informed care. Another way of expressing this need, in the mythopoetics of our lives, we can call it the hunger that never quite goes away, no matter how fulfilled we might be in our lives. Yeah. We are always needing. Another way we can express it is this desire to be attached, to be attached.
Sure, yeah.
And attachment literature and attachment theory has come a very, very long way. So that we know that this need to be attached is supported by great evidence within research literature, and that we can moderate and modulate and respond to that need in marvelous ways that produces a sense of balance and calm, even when our need to be attached is great. Does that give you some of the basics? From a heartfelt point of view.
Absolutely.
What those terms are.
So, Ms. Tree, as you were speaking, I was thinking of my own deep need that I have and fears too. For example, I've always felt a real need to have intimacy. And that seems like a basic human need to me. How do we get more in touch with what that need is to become more aware of what our most basic needs are so we can become aware when those needs are being interfered with or shattered? And I can think of how traumatic experiences that really touch on that deep need we may have can be, as you put it, it's not just the external experience, but it becomes something that is so profound that it can affect you in ways that you can't even entirely understand sometimes. How do you get in touch with that sense of what your need is and become more aware?
Well, this is a very, very important question because it goes right to the heart of what it means to both be restorative, be healing-centered, be trauma-informed, be disability-aware in this kind of world that we live in, where being trauma-responsive, responding to need and getting in touch with them comes right up against this burning ethos. And I say burning because it's like a chemical burn that keeps going long after the principal fire has been set into motion. And it is this notion in Europe and America that is white dominated especially, but it is not just confined to so-called white people. It is this notion that human beings are individuals defined by our own highly individuated, super personal needs. And that go it alone, dyed in the wool, from the bootstraps vision of life is the first conceptualization that ironically has to be thrown out in order to get in touch with our private and personal need, as well as to become a force for the cultivation of care, radical nurturing in the world, to become truly compassionate and contemplative, to become peacemakers and caretakers. These are the greatest things that the world truly needs and has always needed at this time and every time. And I dare I say that because I'm making a very grand and blanket statement.
Yeah.
So to replace that notion of the super individual, we have to have a very deep and abiding understanding of our blessed interdependence with each other. We must view the world as an expression of our dependence on each other to feel good and be great. We have to have a world, and we have to have communities and institutions where we are actively depending on each other to feel good and be great. And I emphasize optimal existence because it is the crisis within which we live, that optimal existence is only afforded for some and not all. And we can easily get into situations where we envision that there are others that we don't have to depend on, and there are others that we are not going to offer this blessed interdependence. And all kinds of things come up when we are challenged to be truly interdependent. All kinds of things, like, for example, this desire to have power over others, power expressed in hierarchies, which is a remarkable obsession of our species, this last human species on Earth. So ironically, getting in touch with our need to be interdependent with others can then help us to locate what our needs are. As we create a world where feeling good and being great is a shared experience. Because peace is not just the absence of violence, it is the conditions that enable us to be able to look deeply within ourselves.
You know, it strikes me as the really fundamental delusion of this civilization dominated by this hyper-individualism and, you know, determination is just to get more and more and more that we have in capitalist culture. This notion of a self that is radically interdependent, as you have in Buddhism, but also in many indigenous, all indigenous cultures, really, is a sense that we are who we are because of each other, and there's not really any way we can extract ourselves from those relationships. It strikes me as the root simultaneously of our healing, but also of creating a more just and caring community.
That's right. And there is really no division between those states.
Mm-hmm.
A right. truly healing-centered world that is also just. And so there's no separation.
Yeah. Talk about that for a minute, because I think that's a really important concept, particularly when we think about how we create learning spaces. And I don't want to put you on the spot here, but it came up as you were speaking, and I think you'll have something to say about this. I think often about how we can create a learning space, whether we call it a classroom or something that happens in our own home or whatever, a learning space in which that's rooted in justice and liberation, and how that relates to how we care for each other in that space. I think sometimes those are thought of as separate concepts, like one of them is the category of social justice, right? And the other one is sort of the category of social emotional learning. I want to integrate those two. Think about how they're not really that different. Could you speak to that a little bit, and maybe in your own work as a teacher, or just in general terms, like how you think those are connected?
Well, in Buddhism, they call it paticca samuppada, loving interdependence. Mm. And it's not just between us as human beings, but it's between things.
Mm-hmm.
So there truly is not a division between social justice and social and emotional learning, or the kinds of things that they used to call the soft skills, treating each other well, being able to work well on a team, being able to be well self-managed and good decision-making. Things like that. But it all comes down to a concrete example that sat with me today of a teacher who I read about on the internet who was full of rage against their students for not turning on their cameras within the pandemic-enabled online learning space, who had also, with her community of teachers in the institution in which she was teaching, created a rule whereby the children could not wear pajamas or clothes that would indicate a certain relaxation as they were studying online. And this goes to the heart of the steps that we make when we don't think that our ability to work for a self-managed world, a world where people are managing those things that can be the most challenging for their success, is not also a just, a caring, a nurturing, and a good endeavor.
Yeah.
Because it just so happens that there are all sorts of reasons, diverse and innumerable, of why a child might not wish to turn on their camera at times, why a child studying in their home might need to be within relaxed, informal dress. And it has nothing to do with developing their pre-professional skills and getting them ready for a successful life. It could be an equity concern that their homes are full of strife, that their homes are full of disadvantage, that they don't have the access to the kind of ready-made clothing that is perfect and professional in every way, that there might be some kind of trauma, recrimination, or a home full of multiple generations with lots of kids, or even a mother home working, where seeing what's actually within the home might produce a discomfort within the child. A world where we are not taking into account the presence of multiple different kinds of needs that a child might have within that learning space is a devastating one. And there is no justice that can be performed when it does not also consider what it means to truly care for and be loving to the people that we are so honored and humbled to teach. I always say, Ted, that there is a kind of person in a world that is the most marginalized. Do you know what that kind of person is?
I don't think we've had this conversation before, no. Tell me, Ms. Tree.
Children.
Sure.
There is no kind of human being that is more marginalized than a child. Why? Because a child has no rights of autonomy. None. A child can even, when they, in many jurisdictions, when they commit a mistake, be tried and imprisoned as an adult, taking away even their status as a child.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They always have to act in locus parentis. The parent is always a proxy for their own autonomy. And so that's why nurturing and this kind of care and listening to the variable experiences of a child, and at times encouraging them with great affirmation. Okay, well, I want you to get into the rhythm of turning on your camera for the next time, Junior.
Right, yeah.
And maybe this time you can really give it a try. Hey, come on, give it a try.
Yeah, sure.
Because you can do it.
It strikes me that for a few different reasons, it would do us all some good to remember our own experiences as children and what it's like to be a child. And that so often I think we think that as adults, we have to forget that or put it behind us and be more adult-like. But it would do us all some good, I think, to really remember what it's like to be a child.
It would also do us some good for us to get some training within child development.
Sure, yes.
And to know that a child is not fully formed yet within their brains. Whole areas of their brain need activation, continual activation, and to be able to prompt it to grow out and to discover more reasoning within their frontal lobe. Their very bodies need the kind of development. They are not even fully developed in key ways in order to make the best of decisions, even up until the age of 21.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
I believe that a lot of the things that we do within our invigilating and punishing strategies for education go against basic science for child development. And
it astonishes me how we have these sort of pseudoscientific approaches to education that ignore the actual science. You mentioned before the soft skills, right?
So-called,
yes, exactly. And that's sort of a condescending term, I think. It's what we're, you know, it sort of looks down on those areas of humanity. When in reality, paying attention to the so-called soft skills, paying attention to things like human development and the emotions and all those things, that's actually the real scientific approach to learning. And so often we have these pseudoscientific approaches with zero tolerance and all that sort of thing that ignores the actual science of human development.
So in the space of our education, when we want to engage with a child to boost them and uplift them in favor of making these harsh rules that hyper-regulate, in the face of always telling them to behave instead of behold the world with curiosity and insightfulness and openness, what concretely can we do with our voices as action to guide them to a space where they will be in the position to be open to the learning that we have to offer and be able to self-direct and guide their own learning? What can we concretely do? Because I believe If I have done anything within my life, it is over the last 3 years to develop specific practices that are the embodiment of healing, of creating the conditions that respond to our needs, that reify our interdependence, and that continually activate uplift to create optimal experience, to enable us to do better and feel good, and even to be great. What do? I work with a collection first off. There are others, but just dealing with affirmation first. Under the rubric of affirmation, I work with around 19 at least different engagement processes that are indicative of the way that we speak and what we say to the children and adults to create these and foster these healing centered, these radically nurturing, affirmative, trauma-informed, disability-aware states. Among them are acknowledging, advising, clarifying, controlling, encouraging, helping, giving, inspiring, listening, motivating, offering, reassuring, recognizing, supporting, praising, protecting, thanking, validating, valuing. For most of my professional life, I have operationalized these particular engagement strategies, and they, I have found, create the conditions that allow those with whom I'm working to reach beyond the hyper-corrective experiences that they have been involved with in the past, to find states of learning and states of experiencing where they feel truly welcomed, approved, embraced, confirmed, where they really truly feel like they're receiving a consensual, gain-specific, and obtain-enabling way of being. Now, I would like, if we have time, to give examples of each one of those states and what it would mean to say something that would be acknowledging.
Why don't we dive into that, Ms. Tree? Let's take a quick break, and then we'll get back, and we'll do that. Does that sound good?
That sounds great.
All right. Our statement of intent. One, the planet and humanity are at a moment of crisis and opportunity and a transition. Two, because we are entering into an unknown future, imagination is paramount. Three, this moment requires new stories, new narratives, new creative works that express this reimagining. Four, we believe that these narratives must challenge and confront the injustices of our day. Five, the crisis of the moment is an educational crisis. That is, we must reimagine educational processes in order to reimagine our narratives. Six, we welcome educators, poets, philosophers, activists, and writers who are interested in reimagining ourselves and our relationship to the planet. Seven, reimagining is a place not so much to find quick answers or definitive solutions. Rather, it is a place to ask big questions, to explore possibilities, and to imagine a new world. You can find more about our work at www.reimaginingmagazine.com and more about our broader mission at www.chicagowisdomproject.org and www.baltimorewisdomproject.org. Welcome back to Reimagining. My name is Theodore Richards, and I'm speaking with Miss Tree Turtle on reimagining healing. Miss Tree, you were talking about affirmation. Could you continue?
Yes, and I was sharing that through most of my professional life and my engagement as an educator, I've tried to operationalize, to put into motion with my words and my actions, as I engage, especially with children of all ages, but also with the adults that I have taught and have had the pleasure of engaging in different teaching contexts. About 20 or so, and right now I'll mention 19, of these affirmational strategies. The case I have in mind is the case of the child in a online learning classroom that won't turn on their camera and become involved and participate like the teacher, like the school district, like the school wishes them to. So the rule then becomes you must turn on your camera, instead of engaging a practice where we first say, I see you there, Junior. I see you, Junior. Even though you might not have your camera on, I sense that you're there. Can you type a little bit in the chat and let us know that you're there, dear? Or you can raise your hand. In time, I'd like you to really feel like you can turn on your camera just a minute. And the next time you want to advise them and give them an alternative of how to do that. Hey, let me give you some advice, Junior. How about thinking of it as a 10-second countdown just to get used to what it means to have your camera on? So start by looking around your space and making sure that you feel comfortable in your space and that everything is in the order that you want it to be when you turn it on. This is the advice I'm giving you. And let's just do a 10-second countdown. Everyone, let's do it together too. Okay, 10, 9, when I get to 1, you're gonna turn it on. 7, 6, remember, it's only gonna be on for 5 counts after we get to 1, okay? And finally, you get to 1. Okay, camera's on. 1, just 5 seconds. 2, 3, 4, 5. Okay, you can keep them off or you can keep them on. And let's move on with our lesson. Advise, clarify. And you know why, everyone, it's so important to have the camera on? I don't want you to think that this rule is arbitrary. It's important because sometimes when I'm able to see you, to see your faces, I'm able to understand you better. I'm able to gauge what your reactions are to some of the things that I'm saying and some of the things that your classmates are saying. I'm also able to say, hey, you got it. Or maybe you didn't, and I need to then explain it in a different way. Oh, but Junior, moving now to consoling. But Junior, I see that there is hurt that you're feeling. And you're okay. And I want you to know how much I deeply care about you. Nothing that you do right now is more important than you just finding your own way and feeling that you're cared for. Is there anything that I can do right now? In fact, let me help you by doing this. And let me help you by doing that. And if you allow me, I can do this. So you both help them and offer specific strategies and you give to them. Well, let me give you this that can help you in this particular instance. I also want you to know that you can truly do this. You may think that it's a challenge to be fully present because of everything that's going on, but I believe in you and I know that in just one more session, this is something that you can do. And when you do it, you'll feel so much better. That's encouraging. And hey, just doing it is going to fill you with pride because you're the most important person here. And if everyone feels that they're the most important person here, then we have a room full of the greatest of importance. You're inspiring them. So tell me, Junior, just write in the chat how you're feeling right now. Tell me why. And it's okay. Your reasons will not penalize you. There'll be no punishment. I'm here just to listen. That's just listening. Hey, but then when you do it, Junior, you're going to feel that you have achieved something truly great. And that That's what I am looking for. My hope is that you will reach that threshold where you'll say, you know, I got it. I did it. And I could do it, and now I did it. That's motivating. Sometimes it's also important to offer and reassure. Well, how about if you don't want to do it, I could do it. I turn it on with my controls. Or let's create a situation where you and Susie can have your camera off, and then someone else could have it on, and then you could trade up. I also want to make sure you know that there will be no harmful responses that will come to you. Reassure them, especially for safety's sake. And then recognize their importance too. Recognize their importance as they do it. All of this is an act of supporting when they do it and turn on their camera. Praise them for it. Don't miss that opportunity. And also urge them to know that they can be and will be protected. Don't forget to thank them and to thank everybody as you reach for an experience where you can be validated and valued. These are some of the states that operationalize affirmation as you work through these experiences, and they're improvisatory, but quite well thought out and rationalized in their effect that they can have. And they require its own kind of work.
A lot of what you were saying, Ms. Tree, had to do with this distinction that I would make between care and or affirmation and punishment. Why is it we're so obsessed, particularly in certain, I think, communities, so obsessed with punishment as a solution to all of our challenges? Where do you think that stems from, and how can we move on past, get people to think in a different way about how to approach people rather than always thinking that punishment is the solution?
Well, we don't have a sophisticated understanding of power within many of our cultures, communities, institutions, state practice. We don't think of power as animating from the radiance of loving practice, radiating compassion that is never eliminated, even when individuals are held to account, when they must be accountable for their behavior and amends must be made, specific strategies to account for harm that individuals or institutions have created. Oftentimes, punishment occurs in the absence of accountability, where just making someone suffer or feel bad has no concomitant work of healing, of making amends, of restoring the kind of order that is needed to make the community better.
Right.
That's why, for me, there should never be even a such thing as punishment. Rather, we make amends, we hold accountable, and oftentimes that accountability will mean giving up power so that you are not able to harm or be in a position to harm, and so that you can then go into a contemplative space. Mm-hmm. Then to make a reconciliatory response, to do these affirmational states, but from a different vantage point, to offer, to help, and to support because you have harmed others and you want to make amends. And when you punish, you eliminate all hope for an intrinsically valued situation of accountability, of making amends.
That's right, yeah.
It's all extrinsic and imposed and retributive and often leading to the worst of suffering. Mm-hmm. It's a form of violence. If you're not literally doing violence to someone by physically harming them, you're doing emotional violence. So for me, there is no place within truly sophisticated and even basic human exchange that is really understanding our needs as human beings on a humanist and humanitarian level, really understanding our need to be attached to one another and interdependent, that has anything to do with punishment. So I am truly a restorative justice practitioner in that regard, but I'm also the kind of professional that believes that the three tenets, the first three tenets of restorative practices must be well known throughout the world. First is that we are essentially good people. The second is we make mistakes. The third is we can change. And the fourth is we change when we realize that we are interdependent with others and therefore must depend on each other to feel good and be great. These are the principles that are the bedrock of what we do. We're so afraid because we have hierarchical systems, hierarchical worlds, elitist practices, and we live in worlds where power is differentially equated and distributed in unfair ways. We have a very poor understanding of the need for mistakes. We need to make mistakes in order to learn. Sometimes we cannot just do it. We have to do the trial and error. Any artist knows that quite intimately. In order to be able to create some of the systems and structures in many different artistic disciplines, and including and even in science and experimentation, you have to do trial and error.
Yeah.
So,
you know, I like to think about that. Another word for trial and error, another word for that kind of creative exploration that happens in science and in art. We tend to put fancy adult labels on that process, but another word for that, I think, is play. And it's the act of creating and recreating and reimagining and exploring the world and seeing what works in a way that's organic. And maybe we can't know the answer in the beginning, but we fumble around and figure something out in the process. And hopefully it's a little joyful in the process too.
And sometimes it isn't joyful, but it can be beholding.
Mm-hmm.
Behaving.
Yes, that's right.
And
that's right. Healing can be hard. And this work you're describing is hard work. It can be joyful, but it's not easy.
It really isn't. And mistakes can be quite hard and searing, especially when we realize how much we've affected others' lives with our mistakes. That's where accountability must run deep.
Yeah.
And it must cultivate a place where we can be honest. When we're just punishing, people are afraid. They lie.
That's right.
And they're afraid of being punished, afraid of being hurt further, even though they made a horrible mistake. So they lie. They can't begin the journey to move from their mistake to accountability, to amends, to restoring themselves. And I mean really grave, grave errors, because I've done a lot of work and teaching within incarcerated facilities. And let me tell you something. Most of them did it. Just the Innocence Project here. And so, the first thing they run down to you when you work in these facilities, yes, they did it. So you stop from there, you say, look, they made these terrible, sometimes really grave, spirit-crushing offenses. And then how do you regard them as human beings from there? Knowing that you have to have those principles intact, if your restorative principles are off and you don't actually know the fact that people can change.
Yeah,
they do change.
And the mistakes that they made were shared among all of us, because no one makes choices entirely alone. We are individuals, and at the same time, we're all sharing in this world and sharing in each other's successes and failures.
Yes. And no, because I have done work with sex offenders who have raped, and including rape children. I am a survivor from the ages of four, below the age of four, of horrible crimes, including sex crimes perpetrated by adults that almost killed me. I mean, imagine an infant's body, a body of 5 years old, being subjected to that kind of torture and sex trafficking. That's what I went through. And I'm going to tell you something. Most human beings do not commit those kinds of crimes.
Sure.
And we do not share into that kind of terrible acts of suffering and harm.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, our capacity for radical empathy can help us to move to a place where even those who have committed those terrible crimes, we don't take away their humanity. And this becomes very, very important, because once you have felt that kind of suffering and you have felt what it means not to be able to walk, use the bathroom, to be degraded, and you've had it happen all of your life, like I have during my formative years, the powerful notion rises to the fore. I would never want anyone to experience anything like what I've had, even my worst enemy. It's so terrible that I wince even to think that there's someone, people are always playing around with the idea of getting raped. Go put them in prison. So they're raped in prison. And I often say, gosh, that person may have never been raped before.
They just
don't know to wish it on someone else. I think it also becomes a measure of our own humanity.
That's right.
Our whole humanity becomes debased when you even think of doing that.
Yeah. Ms. Tree, we're almost out of time. Generally, our practice is to close with an opportunity to give our guests to do some reimagining, to think creatively and radically about their vision. And so we're talking about reimagining healing today. So if you could just speak a little bit about how you envision our communities, our schools, however you want to take it, our homes, our world, how do you see, if we can adopt these healing practices that you've described, what's your vision for adopting those practices and what's the world you'd like to see reimagined through those practices?
Well,
it's a big question, but briefly on that big question.
We've been dealing blessedly with big questions all evening, and that's
sure.
But it occurs to me, of course, that everything that I'm doing and that you're doing is reimagining. And reimagining healing in the way that I'm saying is goes against many of the established orders around us. Just to have a radically affirming environment that gets the kind of learning in our classrooms that we want for our students without correction, because I'm a firm believer that most of what we can do in a classroom, we can get that learning to be fostered without any correction. I know that might sound
radical,
possible to many people, but if I could give you the case studies, including the case study that I just gave about this small case of Junior who won't turn on his video camera in the online learning space during the pandemic. But if we could only begin to learn how to acknowledge, advise, clarify, console, encourage, help, give, inspire, listen, motivate, offer, reassure, recognize, support, praise, protect, thank, validate, value, then to reach for a greater sense of acceptance and welcoming and approving and embracing, confirming and receiving, consenting and gaining and obtaining. If we were just to start there with these affirmational processes, knowing that there's so much other work in restorative practice, in restorative justice, in healing-centered engagement, there's so much, but if we could just start there, that is where the hope might lie in being able to truly reimagine, not just in our minds, but in our actual practice of everyday engagement with others. So we get out of the corrective sphere and into the affirmational sphere so that we try within our engagement to eliminate stereotype threat when people start being the stereotype that is forced on them, where we start intervening into learned helplessness, where people feel like they're flailing and failing at the same time. And where we're very, very sensitive and tender in the face of trauma. If we can just start with these active practices of affirmation, I think that we can do what many people think is impossible. It will require resisting the constraints that are placed on us within our institutions. But I don't just think that these affirmational practices, Ted, are germane to classrooms. I think that they should be present wherever we engage with others, right, including other species.
Ms. Tree Turtle.
Yes.
I want to thank you for your work, for your wisdom, and for reimagining with us today. You've given me so much to contemplate, not only in my work, but in my own life. So I'm extremely grateful for your work. Thank you.
Oh, thank you. It's such a joy to be here with you, Ted.
The Reimagining Podcast with Theodore Richards is a production of Wisdom Projects Incorporated. Original music by Cosmos Ray. Sound engineering by Jim Qualley. Thank you for listening and for reimagining with us.